Once upon a time, there was a town that was located at a very sharp and dangerous curve in the road. There were many accidents on that dangerous curve, and there had been some road signs that had been placed there over the years, but many of them had disappeared. Some had rusted, some had fallen into disrepair, many were unreadable. And one day, a traveler came into that town and saw that there were a lot of people with injuries in that town. There were broken arms and broken legs. There were those who were in wheelchairs. Some of the broken bones had never been set properly and were protruding at very grotesque angles. He noticed that many of those who were wounded were teenagers, and they were the ones with the broken bones and seemed to be a disproportionate number of them, but many who had been injured. And so he stopped and talked to one of the townspersons and asked them what had happened. And the individual whispered to him that they were involved in the accident on that dangerous curve. The traveler asked why there weren't better signs and why there wasn't more being done to teach the townspeople about the dangers of the curve. And the townsperson whispered, "It's embarrassing to talk about those kinds of things. In fact, there are a number of parents who have been involved in that accident as well, and they find it somewhat hypocritical to talk to their children about that curve." And as the town person slipped away, he whispered to the traveler, "We just don't talk about those things here." Obviously, that's a parable, and it's an approach that many individuals have taken as parents and even as a church when it comes to talking about love and dating and sex and marriage. And for far too long, we've been silent in the church about God's perspective on physical intimacy, God's perspective on sex. And in fact, many have said, well, that God just says don't do it. We don't talk much about these things, and we begin to see around us the carnage that's coming as a result of that. And so, and in a point to address that, there are some who have begun to have that discussions, and others who have taken it perhaps a little too far and almost made it sound like the locker room. So this morning, my goal is to attempt to stay in between the two extremes of what might be there so that we might understand what God had in mind when He designed the physical intimacy between a husband and a wife, between a man and a woman. My goal is to keep it PG, so I think we'll all be safe here this morning as I think in terms of our particular church family. We've been studying through the book of Song of Solomon, or Song of Songs, that is the highest of songs, that's written for us, and it is a book about marriage, it's a book about dating, it's a book about courtship. I've entitled our series, Love Song, and we've thus far looking at God's perspective on love, dating, sex, and marriage. That God has designed marriage to be a special gift for our enjoyment while we live here on this earth. For far too many people, their perspective on marriage is something that has to do with the three rings. First, there's the engagement ring. And then comes the wedding ring. And then comes the supper ring. And that's not exactly, well, that isn't at all what God designed when He chose to give to us the privilege of marriage. A quick reminder of where we've come in the book of Song of Solomon, Song of Songs. First of all, the three main characters. If you've been with us, or just a quick reminder, Solomon is the groom. He's the one who has been pursuing his bride and his fiancée at that point, and so he's been pursuing her. And we notice, first of all, the fact that he enjoyed her. There was that aspect of him, and we read about him in the Scriptures. He's the one that's recorded for us. There's the bride or the fiancée at one point in time. We're not given her name. We've just called her Shulamith. She's from a Shulamite, and so we've just given her that name, even though we're not given a particular name. They're the daughters of Jerusalem that we find, and they're the chorus that from time to time shows up in the book, and we've suggested that those are the best friends forever of that girl, of that Shulamith as she grew up. These individuals who had not experienced what she is experiencing, but is watching her and observing some of these things in her life. When we first started our study a few weeks ago, we looked at the area of attraction and what are the things that we should be looking for when we are pursuing and considering at some point in time becoming married. What are the things that we should find attractive? And that attraction shouldn't end at the wedding. It ought to continue on in our marriage relationships, that we should continue to demonstrate and work toward being attractive to our spouse. Secondly, we looked at the area of courtship. What is it that we are to be involved in when we are finding out that we believe that this is the person that God has for us, and looking specifically at 12 of those little foxes that can come in and begin to gnaw at our relationship prior to marriage, but also when we get involved in marriage, and there are the things that can destroy. The little things often are the things that continue to work. This morning we want to look at the wedding and the wedding night, the honeymoon, and then next week as we pick up, it follows along with what happens after the honeymoon, that reality sets in and life sets in and struggles set in. And we find those even being addressed in the Song of Solomon. It's fascinating that God includes those things, that some of the challenges that we face, you know, what happens next. But this morning I want to look for us at us to look together at what is God's plan for us. Let me give you kind of the outline that I want us to work through together. First of all, we're going to go back and look at the original design, to be reminded of what God had in mind when He designed marriage and the manual that He gave to us. Secondly, we want to look at this specific area in the Song of Solomon, or Song of Songs, the love song, the wedding, and the honeymoon. And then lastly, how does this picture Christ in what He has done for us as well? So first of all, let's begin by looking at the original design. And we're going to start by, of course, looking at the beginning of the book, which is found in Genesis, very first book of the Old Testament, if you want to follow along in that, as God sets us up for this relationship, for marriage. This is what God designed. And it's always neat when I have the privilege to sit down with couples who are contemplating getting married, and we begin the process of talking through some things and then sharing some of these things at the wedding ceremony. We pick up the story. I'm going to start in verse 19 of Genesis chapter 2. And the background, of course, is the fact that God has created this earth. He has created this world, and He's placed the animals there, and He's created Adam and placed him in a garden, and Adam has a perfect boss. He's in a perfect working environment. Things are going well for him. And so we're in that context. And after each day of creation, God said it was good, it was good, it was good. The things that God had done, it was very good. And then we pick it up in verse 19. And out of the ground, the Lord God formed every beast of the field and every bird of the sky and brought them to the man, that's Adam, to see what he would call them. And whatever the man called a living creature, that was its name. That Adam was given a job, a task to do, of naming the animals that God had created. That indicates for us that Adam was not some prehistoric creature. He was a smart guy. He was an individual who had mental capacities. He probably a lot smarter than we are, because over the course of time we degenerate because of from each generation to the next. And the results of that. But Adam's a really smart guy, and God brings these animals and He's giving all of them a name. And the man, verse 20, the man gave names to all the cattle, the birds of the sky, and every beast of the field, but for Adam there was not found a helper suitable for him. I think that's really key. What God is doing is having Adam give these names to animals, and there was a reason behind the assignment. Isn't it always interesting? Maybe you've had teachers that were really, really creative, and they were able to give you an assignment, and you got done, you're working through the assignment, and all of a sudden you begin to realize there's something behind the assignment that they're trying to teach you. There's more to it than just getting it done. And there's more to this than just giving names to animals. That what God wanted Adam to see is that for every animal there was a male and female, but for Adam there was not a complement. There was not one just like him. That wasn't an oops on God's part. It wasn't the fact that God said, oh, I knew I forgot something. But there was a reason behind it, that God wanted Adam to see that there was something missing in his life. There was a complement that was missing in his life. And so we read in verse 21, and so the Lord God caused a deep sleep to fall upon Adam, and he slept, and he took a hunk of flesh out of his side. And the Lord fashioned into a woman a rib which he had taken, or out of the hunk of flesh which he had taken from the man, and he brought her to the man. So God, what God does is he doesn't take a hunk of flesh out of the head so that she would rule over his head, or a hunk out of his feet so the man would rule over the woman, but he took it out of the side so that they would walk together. They would be a complement to each other. And that was God's design. And then we read in verse 23, and the man said, this is now bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh, and she shall be called woman because she was taken out of man. She's linked to me. There's a complement there in verse 24. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and his mother and shall be joined to his wife. Interesting that those instructions are given. Adam didn't have a mother and a father. He didn't have any in-law problems. And he goes on to verse 25, and a man and his wife were both naked and unashamed. It was what God had designed. There was to be an intimacy there. So the creation story tells us that God designed man and woman to walk together in life, to be a complement to each other through life. Jump over to chapter 5 of the book of Genesis in verse 1. And this is the book of the generation of the day when God created man, that He created him in the likeness of God. Now, this is talking about humanity here, that God has taken man. And what does it mean to be created in the image of God? It doesn't mean that God looks like a male or that God looks like a female. It means that we have personality. We have the ability to relate to God because we are persons. And then verse 2, He created a male and female, and He blessed them, and He named them man in the day when they were created. He named them human, named them people. That God created us, God created humanity, male and female. He designed it to be that way. I know in our day there are many who would say, well, that's an old archaic book way back there, you know, from generations ago, and does it really speak to us today? Well, Jesus Himself restated in Mark chapter 10, verses 6 to 8, that He created male and female. That we are designed not to be identical, but to complement each other through life, and therefore we are made different but similar. That there is a relationship. You know, we are made physically to be different but similar. It's what works. We're designed physiologically. We're designed emotionally. We're designed that way by God. That God designed women to be a woman and God designed man to be a man. That was His design, so that when you bring those two together, there's a complement. We're not identical, but there's a complement that cannot happen any other way. So God's original design was a man and a woman committed for life. I realize that in our day there are attempts to redefine and renegotiate and give different terms. And if we would say, for example, to the world around us that this is God's design, there are those who would say, well, you're just a hater. Now, I know, and it's tragic, that there have been individuals and churches that have demonstrated great hate. We've seen the placards, God hates, and you can fill in the blank. And one of the ones that comes to our mind is a group that's entitled or called themselves Westboro Baptist Church. They're not a church. They're not Baptistic, but they are in Westboro. That's the only thing that's really right about their name. And that's not what God designed. And that for us to say, you know, let me just take you back to the original. This is what God designed. It's not because I hate you. It's because I care about you, that this is the only way that this is really going to work. Now, we can do it in a way of hate, and we ought not to do that, but we can say, this is God's instruction. I just want to share it with you if you really want it to work. Let me give you an illustration. Supposing my neighbor decides that he wants to take his family fishing. And he comes to me and says, Dan, I'm going to take my family fishing on Saturday, and we've got our fishing rods, and we've got all our gear, and we're just ready to go. And I look at him, and they're getting ready to pile into the family car, but there's no boat. And I said, you know, what's the deal? Oh, I'm going to use the boat to go fishing. I put floats on this boat and I'm going to take it out into the deep. I'm going to take it down to the Potomac and I'm going to launch it out and we're going to go fishing from the boat. Now, if I care anything about him, I'm going to say, you know, that's not really the best plan. Now, if I don't care about him, what do I say? Hey, that sounds like a really good thing. I think when you hit that boat ramp, you need to be doing about 70 or 80 to see how far across you can go. It's his choice. But one will lead to something that does not give the experience that he's looking for, and the other will. If you want to go fishing with your family, you need to buy a boat. That's what works best. And so as we live in our culture, we go back to what the scriptures say, and this is what God says, who created, designed man, woman, who designed the marriage relationship, something to be enjoyed, and this is his plan for it to work best. Well, let's turn over to Song of Solomon because we want to look at the wedding and we want to look at the wedding night, the honeymoon that's recorded for us. If you want to use a Pew Bible, it's page 680 there in Song of Solomon. We're going to look first of all at the wedding in verses 6 to 11 of chapter 3 and then the wedding night in chapter 4, verse 1 to chapter 5, verse 1. Looking at verse 6. Now, before I jump into it, it's important to understand some background of what happened, because their wedding experiences were a little bit different than ours today. And as was often the case, the weddings were established, you know, mom and dad got together, or dad and dad got together and kind of worked out and planned out the marriage relationship and designed it that way and said, you know, we want you to be together and we arranged the marriage. But oftentimes young people had a chance to say, yeah, I'm for it, or no, I'm not for it. And so there was some of that. And then when that courtship time came, there was a focus on the wedding itself, and the woman would be preparing all kinds of things at her house. And then the groom, as he would leave his house and go to pick up his bride, and then would take her back to his place, and that's where the wedding would happen, with, would be back as his place. And that's how we're going to see it played out here in chapter 3, verse 6. So let's pick it up. This is the woman who's speaking. All of chapter 3, the last part of chapter 3 is a woman speaking. When we get to chapter 4, Solomon himself begins speaking. We don't hear much of Solomon, but when he speaks, we'll listen to what he has to say. So here's the woman as she's watching. What is this coming up from the wilderness like columns of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and frankincense, with all the scented powders of the merchant? Behold, it is a traveling couch of Solomon and 60 men around it of the mighty men of Israel. Now that's quite a sight. She's been looking out. She's been waiting for her groom to come. And sometimes it was just a matter, I'm going to be there on such and such a day. You just be ready. So she's been looking out and watching, waiting for him to come. And she looks out the window and she sees the dust, perhaps cloud, as he's coming. And notice what he has. 60 mighty men around it. David had 30 mighty men, Solomon's father. Solomon has 60 mighty men. I mean, that's pretty impressive, isn't it? 60 groomsmen showing up. That's quite a wedding party, wouldn't it be? So here come these mighty men around of Israel, all of whom are wielders of the sword, expert in war. Each man has his sword at his side, guarding against the terrors of the night. There's protection that's coming. That would have been quite the sight for her to see. That these are warriors. These are the strongest of the strong. These would be the Navy SEALs. These would be the Army Rangers that are coming to protect. And Solomon is offering to her protection. If you're in a dating relationship or considering that kind of thing and the person you're with, you don't feel protected because of the way they treat you, you need to get out of that. Here's a woman who entrusts herself. She says, I can trust him. He's going to protect me in life, not only physically, but emotionally, and not going to hurt me. And so these are the mighty men that are coming. I don't know, I've seen some pictures of like the Air Force Academy, the chapel there, where individuals have gotten married, and you see these, I don't know if they're officers or whatnot, but man, they're in their dress uniforms, and they're standing there with swords drawn, and you know, it forms a V-shape, and down through the middle come the bride and the groom. I mean, it's a beautiful sight. There haven't been any 60 standing there. But that's an impressive sight, and she sees that, she feels protected. He made, verse 10, he made his post of silver and black gold and seat of purple with fabric, with the interior lovingly fitted out by the daughters of Jerusalem. She's describing his limousine. That as he comes, this is something beautiful, and she's going to be taken up. It was carried on shoulders of the individuals, and they were taken back. And she just sees all of this, and it's an impressive thing. So she says in verse 11, go forth, O daughters of Zion, and gaze on the king of Solomon with the crown and with which his mother has crowned him on this day of the wedding and on the day of his gladness of heart. And as you read that, it's really interesting to read that, because you notice it talks about a crown on a wedding day. This is not Solomon's royal crown. This is a wedding crown, which is often given on a wedding day. And it is a stamp of approval by his mother on the choice of his bride. You know, you leave mom and dad when you get married, but you're still connected to the family. And here's a mother-in-law basically saying, I approve, and I'm glad that you're getting married. She approves of that. And so marriage is this aspect of it's a covenant. It's a commitment that's being made. It's not a contract. It's not 50-50. Well, if you do your part, then I'll do my part. If you don't, I'm out of here. That's not what is designed. As you read through this, there's commitment that's taken place here. There's a security. This is for life. And this is a matter we're going to join together. This is going to become us. The 1 + 1 = 1. It's kind of crazy math, but it's godly math. And that we no longer have his and hers. It's now ours. When I counsel and talk with couples who are preparing to get married, I tell them one of the worst things that you can do is separate your stuff. If you come in with stuff separated, this is mine, this is yours, you're almost planning for failure. I think, too, for the vast majority of individuals who think about prenuptials, we're going to make this plan because if it doesn't work, this is what we're going to sign on. Pam and I have no plan for it if it doesn't work. We've committed for life. And you need to hold us accountable if there's some point in time where, I mean, sure, everybody has their struggles and their challenges, but man, it's been a good ride. But if there's some point in time, you come alongside and say, you made a commitment before God. That's the purpose of having witnesses at a wedding ceremony is to say, you guys made a commitment before God that you're going to make this thing work. And the world needs to see that. Needs to see God's plan. So that's the wedding. And we will walk carefully where angels fear to tread into chapter 4, verse 1, and on into chapter 5, verse 1, which is the wedding night. And as we read through this, there are some portions I'm going to leave out, but you can go home and, as a husband and a wife, read them together for your devotions tonight, and you'll find them enjoyable. And you're probably going to ask each other, does this really mean what it seems to say it does? And I'm going to tell you, yes, it does. But you can do that. First thing we notice when it comes to the wedding night is there is tender talk. Now, chapter 4, Solomon begins speaking. Interesting. Solomon begins speaking in verse 1. How beautiful you are, my darling. How beautiful you are. Your eyes are like doves. Doves are gentle creatures. Your eyes are like doves behind your veil. Your hair is like a flock of goats that have descended from Mount Gilead. Now, guys, you're not going to probably want to use that. In our culture, it doesn't translate real well. But what Solomon is considering, what he's thinking about it, they would watch on the mountains. There would come down from Mount Gilead these flocks of black goats that would be descending with the sun glistening off. And here is this woman, his now bride, who has literally let down her black hair. She's let down her hair. And he said, man, that's beautiful. It just reminds me of those beautiful things that I see. Your teeth are like flock of newly shorn ewes. You have come up from their washing, all of which bear twins, and none of them have lost their young. Again, you may want to do that a little different, but it's pretty descriptive, isn't it? Your teeth are like flock of newly shorn ewes. What's he saying? They're white. They've come up from their washing. There's not stuff stuck in between them. Not one of them has lost her young. You have all of them. I mean, here's a guy. He's looking at his bride, and he is beginning the description. He starts really at her head and goes down to her toes. Verse 3, your lips are like scarlet thread, and your mouth is lovely. Your temples are like the slice of pomegranate behind your veil. And as he looks at that, she's got, you know, rosy cheeks, and he's looking at that, and he praises her. Verse 4, your neck is like a Tower of David built with rows of stones on which are hung the thousands of shields. Was he talking about nobility? She carries herself with a sense of nobility. Interesting, in chapter 1, where Solomon describes his wife, or he describes this woman who is not yet his wife, who's had no intimacy with, he stops with that piece in chapter 1 because they're not yet married. And when you read, however, with Solomon, now that they're married, he goes on describing all of her as he goes down through this, because they have now been married and they are in, remember, Genesis, naked and unafraid. So he continues to affirm her. There's tender talk. Verse 7, to reassure her, you are altogether beautiful, my darling, and there's no blemish within you. Verse 9, his heart beats faster as he looks at her. You have made my heart beat faster, my sister, my bride. Now, sister there is a term of endearment. Again, in that day, my sister, my bride, you have made my heart beat faster with a single glance of your eye, with a single strand of your necklace. You know, she's not wearing flannel. She's not wearing sweats. She's not wearing burlap. She is wearing a veil. And as he looks at her, he just reassures her that he really enjoys what he sees. He's grateful for what he sees. Verse 10, how beautiful is your love, my sister, my bride. How much better is your love than wine and the fragrance of your oils. Again, he's taking his time and he looks and he's enjoying her beauty and he's enjoying her fragrance. There's a slow and gentle approach as he is looking at this prized possession that God has given. That a wife is a gift of God to a man, that aspect is not forgotten. Now, Tommy Nelson tells a little story in here, so I'm going to blame him for this, but there may be some reality in someone's life. And he says, somewhere in the process, after being married for 6 or 12 months, it seems like guys go to bed smelling like the exhaust from a two-cycle engine. Or as some women have said, you know, my husband smells like a brewery and I'm not really that attracted to that. They forget about the attraction that still should be there. And ladies, lest you think you get left out, he goes on to say that it seems like women start wearing somewhere around 6 months to a year some nightgown that's made of fake seal skin. You can't see anything through it, even if a solar flare went off right next to it. You can't touch anything. There's no feeling behind it whatsoever. And it's something that her mother passed down to her, and she's going to pass down to her daughter. And that's not what we see here at all, that she realizes there is an attractiveness, there is something special. And then verse 16, again, this is the first time. All of this has been Solomon speaking until we get to verse 16. And the woman is speaking and she says, "Awake, O north wind, come wind of the south, make my garden breathe out its fragrance." What she's saying, north wind is something that is strong. South wind is that which is gentle. So what she's saying, I think the Bible students are right. She's basically saying, bring it on. Bring it on. They've waited in purity for each other. Solomon has approached this with the aspect of reassuring and bringing pleasure to his spouse. And as a result of that, they've come to that place where they can enjoy the intimacy that God has designed. One of the things that's really important for us to remember, guys are made differently than women, and someone has said it this way, and we need to remember this, that men are like microwaves and women are like crock pots. You'll get that. But Solomon, in the context, has reassured his wife and has understood her needs, and his purpose has been to bring pleasure to her. And as a result, he enjoys as well. It's not a matter of what can I get out of it. In fact, Paul writes that when you get married in that kind of a relationship and intimacy, what you do is to bring pleasure to your spouse, to bring enjoyment to your spouse. That's when the highest moments of intimacy come. Look at the last part of verse 5. Drink and imbibe deeply, O lovers. Now, this isn't Solomon speaking, and this isn't his wife speaking. And so the question is, because it comes in the third person, who's speaking here? Now, I've mentioned to you that Solomon is the hardest book to understand and to bring into our day and to comprehend, but a number of the Bible scholars, and I think they're right, feel that this is God speaking. This is after they have enjoyed the moment together, the time together, and God saw that was very good. Just like in Genesis, and they were naked and unashamed. That God has designed for those individuals who are married some of the most enjoyable times and intimate times, and it's God's design within the parameters of marriage between a man and a woman to enjoy what God has granted to us. And it isn't just merely to have kids. I've talked to some individuals who thought, well, the only reason we do it is because we're supposed to have kids. No, that's not why. You open yourself, you become vulnerable to another person. And notice, Solomon is careful with his words. Very careful with his words. Because when are we the most vulnerable? It's when are we the most intimate. Well, what does this tell us a little bit about Jesus? How does it picture? Actually, it's in the context of a reversal. Because here Solomon pursues this woman who he finds very, very attractive. And she is. And what we are told is contrary to this, that Jesus came to love us when we were not at our best. In fact, when we were at our worst. And he desires to take us, our sins and our failures, and to deal with those aspects and to provide cleansing for us. Even if we've made mistakes and broken God's design for marriage in the past, that God desires for us that we confess that before Him. And God wants to put us in white tuxes and white wedding gowns. It's because of what Jesus has done. There may be some consequences that follow us, but The process is that God cleanses us through Christ because we trust Him, and that Jesus went to the cross to bring cleansing so that you and I can be dressed in white, that God looks at us, and it's not because of what we did. We can't clean ourselves up. It doesn't make any difference how much lye soap or Lysol that you put on yourself. You can't get yourself clean. You can't take those little Clorox wipes and say, well, I'm going to clean myself up. It's because Jesus has come. And we've trusted Christ for our salvation. And as a result of that, our sins are forgiven. And we stand before God in the righteousness and the cleansing of Christ. And I trust this morning that that has become your experience as well. That in this journey you've trusted Jesus. Let's close this morning. Four things I'd like to remind us of, depending upon where we are. Number one, to those of you who are unmarried and you want to get married, keep yourselves pure. The wait is worth it. It's worth the wait. You don't have things to explain to your spouse, and you can say, I did this God's way. And you see here where Solomon and his bride, Shulamith, and they're joined together in something that God has designed to be enjoyed by a husband and a wife together through life. So for those of you not married, wait, it's worth the wait. Secondly, for those of you unmarried, you want to be married, and maybe there are boundaries that you've crossed. You can seek God's forgiveness and commit this day to walking in purity before God. I'm going to go on from this day forward. I'm going to do it God's way. You see, friends, it's important that we understand this, because you're probably not going to hear this too much elsewhere, that other than those in the church who teach God's truth, that premarital sex or extramarital sex or whatever harm a good relationship and will prolong a bad one. It will harm a good relationship and prolong a bad one. Let me explain that to you. It will harm a good relationship because there's something happening that is not working on the foundations of developing emotional intimacy and aspects of mental intimacy and figuring those other things out. And you've jumped to a point that's going to harm your relationship. And as I've talked with couples, I've seen that borne out. And sure, when you get involved in engagement and you're working into that time frame, it becomes really even more difficult because you really are attracted to your spouse to be, because that's the way God designed it. And so the barriers need to even be stronger and be higher at that point in time. So it'll harm a good relationship. It'll prolong a bad relationship. Why? Because there's this thinking that passion is the same thing as love. And so individuals will stay in a relationship that is going nowhere, in which they're abused, in which it has no purpose, but they're afraid to get out of it because we enjoy the physical aspects, so they prolong a bad relationship. And so God says, stop. It's not going to work. It's not the way it was designed. For those of you who are married husbands and wives, I encourage you, I challenge you, find enjoyment in the physical relationship that God has given to you. Again, not just for having children, but to enjoy and draw you together in intimacy. And you will understand that God, if 5:1 is correct, last part of it, and God saw it and said it was very good. It was very good. So maybe you want to go home, and later on this afternoon or this evening, or maybe some of you are going to do it this afternoon, you know, you read through your devotions in chapter 4, verse 1 to chapter 5, verse 1. And together as a couple say, you know, what does this mean? And you say, yeah, that's probably what it means. Because God has designed us to enjoy the relationship with our spouse. Lastly, maybe for those here who have not yet trusted Christ, who find forgiveness of sins and our failures, and Jesus offers to us freedom from sin and failure, to take the stains, the blackness, the dirt that we've collected over the years through bad choices and sinful choices, and says, I'm going to get those clean, because Jesus, in His blood, cleanses us from all unrighteousness. And we acknowledge our trust in Him. And God says, I'm going to put white tuxes on you and white wedding gowns on you, because it's what Jesus has done. And when He looks at me, in spite of the fact that there's still sin and failure in my life, but He looks because of what Jesus has done, I confess it before Him. And God says, yeah, I've removed that. That stain is gone. Jesus paid for it. What a great reminder, isn't it, of the love of Christ for us when we weren't very lovable. When we really weren't too interested in the things of God. And yet Jesus came seeking us to take us into the Father's house. Let's pray.